Open Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available from iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
And welcome to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at 89.3 FM, WPFW, Washington. We're also on WPFWFM.org for those who are listening on the internet. This is a Pacifica Foundation radio station bringing you jazz and justice for over 47 years because you, the listener, support us with your social connectivity and financial wherewithal. It does take money to run this 50,000 watt station that brings you jazz and justice, music and public affairs, trying to build a better community one broadcast at a time. All of us here, the 80 some odd programmers, the staff that, like my engineer Mike Nasella, we all try to do our part to encourage you and empower you and the communities in which you live. At this point in the road, that's often but said to many of us, where are we when it comes to current affairs? To help us understand that, to help us understand the practicing of political awareness in action, we have Dr. Clarence Lussain. Dr. Lussain is professor of political science and the director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. For more than 40 years and in more than 75 countries, he has written about, studied, and he's been active in national and international human rights, anti-racism politics, diaspora engagements, U.S. foreign policy, democracy building, and social justice issues such as education, criminal justice, and voting rights. Dr. Lussain is an international expert and observer with European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. Among his many books are The Black History of the White House and his latest, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman versus Andrew Jackson, and the Future of American Democracy. Dr. Lusain, like dare say, dear friend, Clarence, welcome. Welcome aboard yet again, yet another time on this program. How are you?
I'm well, David. Thank you. And welcome to the audience as well.
Well, on air and off air and among friends, there's always a question that's constantly before us. What do black and brown folks do now? And usually the subject is politics. Let's begin with something that I believe will bracket our conversation. You were recently over in Europe. You and I, as well as many listeners, are mindful that the European Union had elections. Tell us about your recent trip to Europe, and what were in the world were you doing in Oslo, Norway?
So thank you for that. So I went to Oslo for two reasons. One was to do some research on the bestowing of the Nobel Peace Prize to Martin Luther King in 1964. The Peace Prize, the Nobel Peace Prize committee does not release information about that until about people who win the prize until 50 years after it's been bestowed. So recently documents became available that I wanted to look at, that I wanted to personally kind of put my hands on. For example, the nominating letter for Dr. Martin Luther King, which came from the American Friends Service Committee. Originally, they actually sent it in 1963, but it arrived too late. So it carried over to 1964. But 1963, of course, was pivotal, as you point out. It really kind of brackets that time to ours. Martin Luther King gave the speech on the Mall. The Kennedy was assassinated. You had the protests and demonstrations in Birmingham and in other places. So 1963 was really kind of a turning point, not only in civil rights, but in U.S. history and global history. And so that was really important, that when Martin Luther King received that award, he had a very different story to tell at the end of 1964. And in his Nobel Peace Prize speech, he connected racial injustice, militarism, and poverty. And if we look at the landscape today, in addition to a range of other issues, those are certainly driving points for our politics. So I went there to, you know, in part to kind of look at that, but also because I teach about race in Europe, I like to be on the ground and to meet with and talk to people in communities that are not what we see as our traditional European communities. And so in Norway, which is generally thought of as a white country, certainly, you know, Donald Trump thinks it is, it's not. There are people there from all over the world. There's a significant Muslim community. When I stayed in Oslo, that's pretty much where I stayed. There are black people there, including African-Americans who have over time have migrated there. And so I wanted to also have discussions with those communities. And again, in the theme of this program, to have a feel for what they see as kind of the driving politics of the moment.
Well, we should even take this early moment to acknowledge the transition of James Lawson, who was an intimate and important colleague of Dr. King, well known for his training in nonviolent resistance, which contributed to all the formation and activities of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Thank you.
All right.
And we're going to miss him dearly. He was an incredible man. Let me take an indulgence and encourage listeners to listen to a speech by him that he gave at John Lewis' funeral. You'll find many touch points, even some that we'll discuss today in our conversation. You talked broadly about politics and history in your sense of discovering the activities around Dr. King receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. But were there any specific things, particularly in Dr. King's own reflections, that you find germane and want to convey to us today?
Certainly. And again, with Reverend Lawson, that was he really was significant for Black politics in the middle to late middle part of the 20th century. And King acknowledged his influence multiple times. So I would argue that one of the contributions of King that perhaps wasn't even appreciated as much in his time as ours was that he really was an intersectionalist. He really did see that there were interrelated issues, and not only at a domestic level, but at a global level. And so he was not a one issue kind of leader, which many in the civil rights movement really narrowed their concern and focus. But King said, no, we have a broader kind of issue, a broader range of interrelated concerns that we have to address, which is why King, while he was during the time he ended up being assassinated, he was making and prioritizing workers' rights and was shifting after the Civil Rights Act was passed and Voting Rights Act was passed to focusing on labor issues that affected not only Black labor disproportionately, but overall. And then you saw him initiate the Poor People's March, which then we jumped to 2024, and we look at the work of Reverend Barber, who is he and others have picked up that banner, and they're exactly right, that these issues are interrelated, and they have to be attacked and addressed politically.
In order to do that, we can acknowledge that Dr. King and Reverend Barber are surrounded by a group of people who empower that, not just a mere generation of ideas, but the actual organizing, the actual enacting of advocacy. And so to answer the question that's in many ways too open-ended about what do Black folk and brown folk do now in the face of a ferocious politics, we can look at the organizing and the, dare I say, the institutionalization. Institution here for both of us, I think, means something more lively. It doesn't mean a stodgy organization,
right,
or a particular building. And it's, correct me or calibrate this, but the importance of building institutions, living organisms, living collectives of people, is a sense of readiness. So we don't succumb to media trends. We don't succumb to trauma. How do you figure out, or better yet, think about the threats and opportunities, but also how we should respond, particularly through institutions?
Excellent question. So to me, it's always a combination of tried and true strategies that have worked, that have been essential, like voting, for example, but also taking advantage of the new technologies, new understandings, new theorizing. So it's never kind of what we did before and what we need to do now, but looking at the ways in which those relate. But most significant is assessing what is the most urgent politics in front of us, and not sort of being stuck in kind of a particular era. And so this, again, relates kind of to my trip to Europe. And I was in Senegal recently as well. And the number one issue that I was asked about again and again and again was how did how is it possible that Donald Trump is a leading candidate in U.S. politics, and how have the far right emerged so strongly? And of course, this has been the issue in Europe as well. In the recent European elections, there's a little bit of distortion in the news. There were certainly gains by the far right in Germany and France and in Italy. And so those are notable. But in a number of other countries, they were either weakened or actually lost ground in Sweden and Denmark and Finland and Spain, in the Netherlands. In all of those countries, the far right actually did not do all that well. And when you kind of sort it all out, there was probably about a 2-3% gain in far right seats. Now, I'm not trying to undermine at all that there is a surging far right across the region, and in fact, across the world, not just in Europe, but, you know, we know here, and you look at certain parts of Latin America, for example, you see a surging far right. So that is a clear and present and in many instances immediate danger, but it's also a fragmented movement. And so we also have to understand that. As you know, my concern in part here in the U.S. is the degree to which people of color have signed on to the MAGA movement, which is a white supremacist, authoritarian, misogynist movement, no question about it. But why are you having these other communities who are really the targets of MAGA, at least, you know, people from some of these communities who are part of that. So that is something that, you know, we should try to get our heads around. And so that's, again, a lot of what I'm concerned about right now.
Well, let's dig in a little deeper. But first, I'd like to reintroduce you. Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, let's focus with our guest, Dr. Clarence Lussain. The show title is At This Point in the Road, Practicing Political Awareness and Action. We'll try to cover both of those essential aspects of daily living. Dr. Lussain, step by step here. So you're mentioning the rise of the right, the sustained conflict that the far right offers. And I can imagine myself in a barbershop, in a social setting, starting to talk about global politics, and in this case with the far right, the use of immigration to mobilize people and push fear buttons. From your own point of view, why should people pay attention to such engines as the rhetoric and actions around immigration, for instance? Why should we look over at Europe and understand the xenophobia and the inhospitable responses to immigrants, to migrants? Why is that so important over here on our side of the Big Lake?
So that's a great question. So one issue is, why is there appeal to the far right by some of these voting bases? And a lot of it from the far right perspective is that it's a failure of the left. In fact, it's a failure of the center. And if you look at these countries in Europe, including the UK, which is no longer part of the European Union, it really has been the failure of the middle, the center, whether it was center right or center left, to deliver and to correctly explain why immigration is important, as opposed to leaving it to the right to frame it as a racial kind of concern. So in the UK, for example, the reason Brexit was successful was because the far right was able to sell it as an immigration issue, but also the Labour Party was not able to effectively counter that argument. And in fact, it bowed into some of the xenophobia of some of its members. And you see that kind of across the region. If you look at Macron in France, for example, same thing. Initially under Angela Merkel and now under Schultz. Again, their positions on immigration was very kind of muddied. It did not challenge this rising racism and xenophobia that came about. And then we see Italy, for example, and there's others. And so that's exactly what's going on here. And now what we see with Biden, for example, is that he has rolled over and been into some of these politics that we see coming from the far right in the U.S.
You made an initial allusion, failure to deliver. So rhetorically, I'm going to say deliver what? I suspect it's a notion of good feelings around economic stability and the inability to explain and even point out adequately that immigrants, and I don't even like the objectification there, people who are forced to travel great distances because of the impacts of colonialism, global economics, and life-threatening dangers to their human rights and human existence. Political leadership has failed in moral imagination and leadership to adequately explain that there's plenty of room, plenty of resources, and it's the right thing to do to relate to people properly.
So yeah, I definitely think that's part of it. It's also painting a narrow picture of immigrants. So the immigrants that come from Canada and that come from other places, you know, are not seen kind of in this other category because they have not been demonized. Although there are people on the far right who are calling for stopping all immigration from everywhere. But again, it's centered on a particular notion of immigrants is different, as they look different, they pray different, they eat different, and using that to tap into people's paranoia about the harm that will come from all these different people being in your country.
Well, let's tap into the survey. I don't know if immigration was categorically part of that, but it's certainly a lever to particularly, and I'm going to be outright about this. This was a survey of black clusters of black population that you conducted. And in the mainstream news, the common drumbeat right now, which I think is a drumbeat of distortion, is that black males and brown males are there's a peel off of them joining the MAGA movement.
So we have a polling group at Howard University called the Howard University Initiative on Polling. And so we periodically to diversify how polling happens, we will do polls specifically targeting black communities. Some are national, some are more state focused. So we've done a couple of polls and they've shown some consistency with national polls in terms of people saying and a little bit surprising high numbers that they would support Donald Trump, anywhere from 18 to 25%. For example, with there being a gender gap with black males higher than black women. But these are snapshots. And I really want to underscore that, because in the end, it's not kind of what people say, it's what people actually do. And if you look at 2018 midterms, you look at the 2020 presidential race, you look at 2022 midterms and other elections, and what you find is that the Republicans still get anywhere between 6 to 8 to 9%. So they're not breaking through at all. What happens is when people really go into that voting booth and they think about, as angry as they may be at the Democrats in general, the policies being offered, the rhetoric being offered by the Republicans is a turnoff for folks. And now, even though we're talking and some of the polls show potentially higher numbers for Donald Trump, when people actually go vote in November and they look at Trump's convictions, his guilty on sexual assault, the corruption and the corrupt business that he ran for decades, January 6th, all of this is after 2020 when he only got 8% of the black vote. So I think that despite what some of the polls may have shown, and even now they're starting to shift again, I seriously doubt Donald Trump will hit double figures with the black vote.
But yet, there's some causes of concern. I'll just ask these things. It's my job to do that. Does that 6 to 8% offer a margin of victory, not only on a national presidential level, but would it affect an important Senate race? Would it affect state races? Would it go down the ticket? Also, we've got a mutual problem here. If that is a very attractive theme to gain profit and attention on the part of mainstream news media, and they keep on repeating it, isn't it at the very least somewhat bothersome or something that we must engage in a certain way? I suspect what you're going to say too is that there's accountability for those who are running, but there's also accountability for those who promote such positions.
So you may have noticed I said I didn't think Donald Trump would necessarily hit double figures, but that doesn't mean that those votes are going to necessarily go to Joe Biden. And what the Democrats should be concerned about is, one, people just not voting, that people for a variety of reasons will simply say, I don't want either one of these guys and I'm staying home. Or people voting for third party candidates, that the polls are showing that to be less likely. And it's not clear that well, it's actually pretty clear that many of those candidates are not going to be on all the ballots anyway. Cornel West, for example, is only on 7 state ballots at the moment. But again, their impact could be to depress the turnout, which is why you have the Republican Party, Republican operatives out there trying to help these independent candidates and third party candidates get on the ballot, because they're assessing that it's going to hurt Joe Biden more than Donald Trump. Although with RFK Jr., that's kind of not really looking to be the case anymore. So they're kind of backing off of some of that.
Well, this may be a good time to note and extend some of your remarks after we take a brief break with public service announcements. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to We the People in this hour. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But importantly, this show comes to you by way of WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, through the efforts of 80 or more programmers who are dedicated to both jazz and justice, music and public affairs, music and news. All that is done for more than 47 years, because my thanks to you, the listener, I join the chorus of staff and programmers to thank you for your financial support and your social connectivity. We're here because you care about the things we talk about and do together. And for that, again, I say thank you. Stick with us, and we'll talk more about this political moment, about perspectives and responses from Dr. Clarence Lussain after we hear some public service announcements. Again, won't you please stay with us?
June is Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thus, CAWI, CPN, ICS, AFI, and Africa World Now Project present the 22nd DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 7th to the 12th, At AFI Silver Theater and Culture Center in downtown Silver Spring, the festival showcases the best in Caribbean cinema with 15 films representing 10 Caribbean countries. Highlights include discussions with filmmakers and Caribbean refreshments. The DC Caribbean Film Fest, June 7th to the 12th, scheduled at afi.com/silver or 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Pacifica National Board and the WPFW Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica Bylaws Amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the pacifica.org website.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. You know, in that first public service announcement, you heard the dulcet tones of Marisa Mutali, who, along with James Pope, produces and hosts Africa Now at Wednesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, and available through SoundCloud and our WPFW archives. Africa Now covers African descendant people, what they do in the world, what they contribute to the world, not only on the continent, but throughout the entire world. That is an example of one of the many programs that you support. My thanks to host Marisa Mutali. I know this afternoon at 1, they're going to cover the important topic of the role of historical consciousness and global student movements. They are related, and find out by listening. Dr. Clarence Lusane, again, thank you for being with us. We ended with what you found in this polling that you did. We made a lot of inferences, and I see you're ready to go. What further do you want to tell us?
So one of the things that we did in that poll and others was also try to get a feel for what are the priorities of the Black community. And we broke that down also by age and by gender. But overall, the number one issue was economy and jobs. People are very concerned and worried about the strength of the economy. Will it hold, job stability? The other issues that were in the top five were affordable housing, racial justice, income inequality, and affordable health care. We were surprised because when we did this poll at the beginning of the year and then later in March, that we thought Gaza would be actually high on the list because it was in the news, and certainly there were African Americans who have been part of the movement to stop the Israeli genocide. But that actually came in like 13th out of 16 different issues that we had put before people.
So it begs the question, why? What you're thinking about this?
So I think it's not that people are unconcerned. It certainly is a long history of solidarity with the Palestinian community, but it's not as immediate, I think, for many people. And so these other issues just kind of rose to the surface. And I saw other polling that pretty much said much the same thing.
Well, this polling of yours does offer something, especially if you speak to a younger generation.
Right.
They have caught on to the historical thread that's been important to many different Black advocates, particularly our gay brothers and sisters, particularly some, not all, I won't even argue many, clergy and religious leaders, and more importantly, students on all sorts of levels. And that is, true justice for us and our communities means everybody, everyone.
Right.
And so these points of advocacy, particularly regarding Gaza, don't come out of a vacuum. People are motivated to dig in, to find out facts, to understand the historical standing not to just readily accept shallow mainstream accounts that leave out terribly important facts. They are mindful not to allow Palestinian victims to be mere numbers and unheard voices.
Right.
And that's a tremendous commitment. And even better yet, they act on those bearings. All this is to say, you've been better than I, but we've been talking about institutions in the sense of collective actions. And that's really the more important meaning. If you don't like the word institution, think about collective action. It takes work. It takes not a wholesale rejection of existing institution and older efforts, but it takes work to understand and respond to present and future situations.
It does, in part because the other side is putting in its work. And so, for example, as I noted, even though support for the Palestinians did not come up, you know, at near the top of the list, that certainly has, again, a long, long history in the Black community. But what we also are seeing is the far right trying to tamper with that. So, for example,
and not only the far right, can I say this? There are a lot of liberal rich people in powerful places that have asked officials and schools to suppress the advocacy for them.
What I wanted to give an example of is how the far right is dealing with this in the Black community. So one of their arguments, and this has come from people like Candace Owens, for example, is that they're trying to say they oppose Israel because Israel is attacking Christians who are also in Gaza. And so they're kind of trying to find different inroads into the Black community on these kinds of concerns, and particularly the religious part of the Black community. But again, there's, you know, pushback on all of that because, you know, it's kind of nonsense. But that's where the other side is putting in, you know, 24/7 work to erode these alliances and erode these important progressive politics.
To counter that, wouldn't you have to focus one's attention not only on an elected official, but what the media is doing?
Sure.
Wouldn't you have to focus your attention on, I hate to keep on falling back, I'm making it trite, but if you're in a setting like a barber shop or you're in a large conversation, you really do have to pay attention to who's saying what, but more importantly, what is being said. And it requires kind of a focus and a discipline, doesn't it?
Yeah. So again, one of the questions that we ask is, where do people get their news sources? And it turns out a large percentage comes from local news, that people aren't watching MSNBC or CNN. They're watching the local ABC or NBC station. And then for a lot of young people, they're getting their news information from social media, particularly Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. So the news sources become very central to shaping the opinions that people have across the nation and in these communities. And so if you're trying to work on these issues, you have to be hyper aware of how people are going to get and what are the best ways in which to kind of reach people on the issues that we care about.
Are you aware, or do you have any notions about, I want to make this as lively as possible, deliberate efforts of education and mutual support, mutual aid, mutual learning to counter all this? That doesn't need to make the mainstream news, but such efforts do need to be present in our communities.
So there are some efforts. For example, the African American Policy Forum, the group that law professor Kimberly Crenshaw kind of heads up. So they've been doing lots and lots of work, and they have a Freedom Summer kind of program that they're doing. So they're trying to, again, network and counter people. There are some really important voting rights organizations, particularly in Georgia, that outreach to the entire country, but pretty much across the South, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama, that are doing just on the ground daily work, reaching out to people, getting people registered in the face of some really sharp attacks coming against voting rights. So you got, you know, people on the ground, you know, doing that kind of work, and they need support. You know, they don't grab a lot of headlines, but you know, it's the really sort of day to day, make it happen stuff that really sort of moves the needle forward.
And I'm glad you mentioned the work in the South and elsewhere regarding voting rights, voting registration, voting action, and interaction with politicians, as your example and my reiteration might indicate. It's not the mere action of voting and going home, or that somehow voting is an elevation of things. It's how do you organize to sustain your community? How do you organize to move through mere survival and get some thriving? How do you organize to celebrate one another and have a healthy and better community for everyone? You mentioned the African-American Policy Forum. If listeners are interested in finding out more information about them, simply go to aapf.org, aapf.org.
Now,
so,
what,
yes,
Dr. So the level of expertise and skills around voting and voting action are actually very, very high. Where there's a gap, however, is in addressing the way in which voting administration is coming under attack. And so there had not been a lot of attention paid to, from the progressive side, I would argue, of positions that actually determine, or at least have a big impact on what happens after you vote. So voting rights groups have been excellent at getting people out to vote, getting people registered, doing turnout, early ballot voting, helping people do mail-in voting, all of that. But what we now understand is that there are election boards, there are commissions, there's work going out of Secretary of State offices and Attorney General offices that will shape the election. And the far right has made that a high priority to basically colonialize those positions.
Well, let's even bring it down a bit further. I sit in wonderment why centrists and liberals don't emphasize and enact policy and have agencies take action when people, poll workers who work under the guidance of secretaries of state and help us vote. Why do they and judges and elected officials face all these threats? And you never hear in mainstream news, so-and-so was apprehended for threatening the life and family of poll worker X. And let me remind listeners that often the hearty participation of these civic duties is done in part by Black and brown women, as we know with the case with Mr. Giuliani and the Atlanta situation. And it seems to me like everybody should be concerned about that issue.
Oh, absolutely. My sister, for example, for decades were poll workers in Michigan. They would sit at the polls and do that kind of work. And I had other relatives who did work similar to Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss, who you just referenced. But a lot of them have been driven out, you know, in part because, you know, some are older and they're just kind of moving on to other things.
But the threats are real. I think that's the driver, isn't it?
It's absolutely. And so there are at least two associations that have formed to protect poll workers. But, you know, I think much, much, much more needs to be done at an institutional level and at a policy level. And so that's really kind of, you know, a stage of protection that has not evolved as strongly as it should have. So again, it's driving out, you know, really dedicated good people, and it's opening the door for people with more nefarious kinds of aims to come in.
I suggested a practicality to our discussion, if you allow me a moment. Folks can try to contact the National Conference of State Legislatures at ncsl.org. They could try to contact the Campaign Legal Center, campaignlegal.org, or the Brennan Center for Justice, brennancenter.org. That and several other organizations have active concerns over these issues.
Yeah, I was going to suggest Democracy Docket, which has probably been the leading force, particularly on lawsuits around everything from redistricting to voting law.
Democracy Docket.
Right.
Okay. All right. Again, listeners, I know some of you don't always have the technology, but do these efforts, everything we're talking about, do it with somebody else. Find that person who might go down to the library with you, or at home, do a search with the references that we're giving you. You listeners, you're listening to We the People. We're at the last quarter of this hour. I'm your host, David Whetstone. I come to you each and every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern on 89.3 FM WPFW, also WPFWFM.org. You get such programming dedicated to jazz and justice, such as Sophie's Parlor from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern on Wednesdays. At the 2 o'clock hour Eastern time, Shewanana, a program dedicated to Middle Eastern affairs with host Zen El Amin. At 1 p.m., Africa Now with host Moisa Mutali. And dutifully, we understand that you want a break from information and you want a way to relax and enjoy the artistic expression of humanity with every noon hour during the week with Don't Forget the Blues. The Wednesday edition comes to you by way of Clarence the Bluesman Turner. All that because listeners like you choose to financially and socially support WPFW. You can do that at any time by clicking the bright red donate button at WPFWFM.org. And importantly, you get our heartfelt thanks for taking that action and supporting your Jazz and Justice radio station. Together, we seek to build a better world, better communities, one broadcast at a time. Dr. Lusane, I need to thank you once again. Where should we end off with a few minutes remaining? What do you want to say about a lively sense of doing things differently and building better institutions?
So I kind of repeat myself many, many times over the last couple of years. We're not going to resolve these crises we have by elections. But elections are important because they help provide the grounding on which we continue to fight. And so the coming elections at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, and not within our control, but at the global level, will be absolutely critical. And so educate ourselves, right? Do the kind of background reading and analysis that really looks at how these policies and how particular who's in office will impact our lives. And this is not to base it on personality, on age, on these kind of superficial factors, but really kind of what are these elected officials going to do? What do they say they're going to do? What have they done? And that really should be kind of the driver. And then based on that, you know, there's the range of participation from just kind of basically voting and taking your neighbors to vote to engaging in the issues and knowing the day after the election, the work continues on. And so that's what I'm most trying to kind of raise the flag around, that whatever happens in November, come December, we still have got battles. Whether the terrain for that battle is better or not, those battles are going to continue. So we have to really kind of prepare for that. And again, there's lots and lots and lots of information that's accessible on every issue that people can think about. And again, I want to encourage people to really kind of, again, look globally, because there are elections that have happened from India to Russia to Europe that are happening in Africa and other places, and have a...
They really do matter, right? They affect us.
They absolutely indeed affect us. They absolutely do. But they also are concerned about our elections here. Everywhere I go, the number one question again is, you know, how is it possible that Donald Trump is a leading candidate? And my answer is because it's not just about Donald Trump. It's about a politics in the U.S. that has surged, that was historically marginal, but has basically ceased and become one of the major two political parties. And that's what's driving, in many places around the world, this far-right insurgency. And so we have to push back on that, because fascist politics in the U.S. are racist politics. And there's kind of no way around that. So despite the fact you might see a Ben Carson or Tim Scott or Nikki Haley and, you know, some other colored folks, let us be really clear. These are white supremacist movements that are coming after people who do not fit their profiles.
So at least do not lose hope. Encourage one another. As busy as life is, we must find the time to pay attention and do the best we can with what we learn. Is that a good reiteration,
absolutely,
sir?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Dr. Clarence Hussain, our discussion of politics and current events right here at WPFW on We the People. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
My thanks also extends to Mike Nasella, our engineer. And again, I can't say it enough to you, the listeners who support this station, not only this program, but this station overall. Thank you for your support. May it be ongoing within your means. Those who are generous both with their time and the wherewithal they provide know that it's being put to our best efforts to serve you and, again, to build a better community one broadcast at a time. Perhaps we'll meet again on the radio. Coming up next, immediately after our close, will be the news 5 minutes before the hour from this point forward. I believe either Sue Goodwin or Chris Banger Drowns will bring it to you. Again, listeners, thanks again for listening, and thank you again for your support. Take good care.
roots of blood and sweat leaves us to our tears. More, more, more love make us cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. Hamas said yesterday that it has responded to a ceasefire proposal from the U.S., suggesting some amendments to the deal in a move that keeps talks alive amid continued devastation in Gaza. A Hamas spokesman said without providing details that the amendments, quote, confirm the ceasefire, withdrawal, reconstruction, and prisoner exchange, end quote. Hamas also expressed concern that Israel might not live up to the terms of the deal, particularly the call for a permanent ceasefire and the full withdrawal of Israeli troops. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said today that some of the Hamas amendments are, quote, workable, while others are not. Blinken did not provide details, but he did question whether Hamas was negotiating in good faith. Qatari mediators said they have seen counterproductive behavior from, quote, both parties. A UN human rights report published today accuses both Israeli and Palestinian forces of sexual and gender-based violence in the first months of the war that began in October. It said both sides committed war crimes and that Israel also committed crimes against humanity. Specifically, it accused Hamas and other militant groups of hostage-taking and deliberate killing of civilians. It accused Israel of forced starvation, deliberate killings of civilians, and collective punishment. It said the scale of sexual and gender-based violence by Israeli forces against Palestinians suggested that such violence is part of Israel's, quote, operating procedures. The report also cited sexual violence against men and women during the October 7th Hamas attack. Israel rejected the report and its authors as biased. UN officials warned yesterday that war crimes could have been committed by Israeli and Palestinian forces in connection with a deadly Israeli hostage rescue operation over the weekend. That operation freed four hostages, but left one Israeli commando dead and killed more than 274 Palestinians, including dozens of women and children. The UN said Israeli forces could have broken rules around proportionality and precaution, while Palestinian groups holding hostages put nearby civilians in danger. Quote, all these actions by both parties may amount to war crimes, end quote. Over 36,000 people have been killed in Gaza since Israel invaded last year. The UN says over 1 million people could experience acute starvation by mid-July. In domestic news, Virginia's chapter of the NAACP filed a federal lawsuit yesterday against the Shenandoah County School Board after the school district restored the names of Confederate generals at two public schools. The school board voted last month to reverse a decision made in 2020 to change the names of schools linked to Confederate leaders Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and Turner Ashby. The lawsuit states that students will be, quote, required against their will to endorse the violent defense of slavery pursued by the Confederacy and the symbolism that these images have in the modern white supremacist movement, end quote. The lawsuit argues that the board violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Equal Education Opportunities Act, the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, and the 14th Amendment, which prohibits racial discrimination in government-supported institutions. A federal court has blocked Florida from enforcing a law that bans gender-affirming care for trans youth and restricts care for trans adults. Judge Robert Hinkle ruled yesterday that the 2023 law is unconstitutional and violates the equal protection rights of transgender people. In his ruling, Judge Hinkle said that gender identity is real and that there is a widely accepted standard of care, including puberty blockers and hormone treatment. The law banning care was championed by GOP Governor Ron DeSantis